Welcome back to the Dealmakers Podcast Show with serial entrepreneur Alejandro Cremades, best-selling author of The Art of Startup Fundraising and co-founder at Panthera Advisors. In this podcast, we ask our guests about their successful acquisitions and financing rounds.
Alrighty, hello everyone and welcome to the Dealmaker Show. So today we have a very exciting investor, you know, we can also call her a founder. You know, she's launched a really exciting venture capital firm, you know, and a fund right now that is, it's pretty big, you know, $100 million to invest in pre-seed, you know, which is something that you don't typically see often. She also recently published a book where we're going to be talking about all types of good stuff, you know, on how to elevate brands, how to elevate the conversation. And then also, you know, like some of the patterns when it comes to investment, when it comes to finding, you know, great entrepreneurs. Again, the building, the scaling, the financing, the exiting tool that she probably sees, you know, most likely, you know, on everything, you know, that she has a finger on the pulse. And then also recent investments, as well as some of the companies that she has invested in that she is the most proud of. So again, brace yourself for a very inspiring conversation. And without further ado, let's welcome our guest today, Kate MacAndrew. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
So originally born and raised in Pasadena, California, give us a walk through memory lane. Kate, how was life growing up for you?
You know, life was pretty great. I'm not going to lie. I had very hardworking parents, and I think they set me off with this belief that I could do anything if I worked hard enough and if I really followed my heart in that. And while they weren't entrepreneurs, I grew up with the entrepreneurial bug. I was the classic person, you know, making my friends peddle Oreo cookie milkshakes around the neighborhood, selling them. And I really grew up with its entrepreneurial spirit and really with a lot of powerful women around me. I went to an all-girls school, an all-girls camp, and I grew up in a kind of high-achieving sisterhood. And I think it really made me who I am today.
So how do you start dreaming about being a CEO when you're, you know, such a young age?
You know, it's really funny. I think the word for me was like, oh, I want to be the boss. You know, I think I just had this leadership quality, and I'm someone who loves the new. I love to break new ground and go into new territory, and it just felt exciting to me. And something that naturally happened was I was very clear about what I was good at and what I wasn't good at. And I was really magnetized by people who had complementary skills. And I loved inspiring them to come with me on whatever mission I was on. And I just found that I did my best work in teams, even as a very young person. And I also was enough, you know, around the business world enough to understand that, you know, companies were really just excuses for groups of people to come together and make things that they believe in. And that has continued to play out in my life as I've gotten deeper and deeper into company building, but it really was planted in me as a child and was very clear that I wanted to run the show.
Now, in that regard, you ended up going to Montreal for studies to McGill University. And from there, you went into Lululemon, you also had your consulting practice. How do you land in the world of ventures, in the venture world?
In the absolute most unlikely way possible, I actually took a year off from consulting to build houses with Habitat for Humanity. I really wanted to give back, and I was also trying to think about getting some spaciousness to make a big decision about going to business school or starting a company. And in that break, I ended up connecting with a group of angel investors who wanted to start an accelerator program. I'll never forget standing on the side of a building, you know, a house we were building, installing siding, and this angel investor asking me if I wanted to help them start this accelerator program. And it's a huge turning point in my life. And the biggest turning point was I just did not understand how investment worked, right? I thought that if I wanted to go get a business education, I had to pay for it. And when they told me that accelerators were about people, you know, investing money into entrepreneurs and then helping them start the business, it really blew my mind of how information could flow, how money could flow, and truly how businesses got built. And so I took that opportunity, I ran that for 2 years, and very quickly I turned around and knew I had to come to Silicon Valley, and I did.
So tell us about going to Silicon Valley. How was that arrival and what were you seeing around and how was that for you?
Well, it was a very special time. I had invested in one startup through the accelerator that was a hardware biotech company. They all lived in a big communal warehouse in Soma, and they threw crazy parties, and it was an incredible brain trust of really genius people who have gone on. They're now running OpenAI and, you know, head of Google AI, really interesting people. And they created this universe and just welcomed me into it. And so I feel like I had an incredibly deep cut into what was happening in San Francisco and the people who were truly passionate about what they were making. So I literally slept on the floor of their warehouse for the first month because I couldn't afford an apartment. One of them falsified an employment letter so I could qualify for my first apartment. And then very shortly thereafter, through networking and going to events, I got my first real venture job. And so it was really a story of young people showing up for young people who were excited about the real work and really community, kind of helping one another find great opportunities. And so those folks are some of my closest friends, you know, to this day.
So tell us about Bolt, because Bolt, you know, was a pivotal, you know, experience for you. You were there for close to 8 years. You went there from the lowest of the ranks, you know, from, let's say, associate all the way to making it to partner. How was that journey like?
It was totally transformational. Never in my life had I had a group of people who believed in me so completely and who just gave me the room to run. It was extraordinary. And I joined just prior to closing of the first fund, which was a pre-seed fund, $32 million. And I was the only employee in San Francisco. Everyone else was on the East Coast. And they basically told me nothing about what I should go do. They just sort of unleashed me onto the city. And I really think, you know, in those years, I not only learned who I was as an investor, right? What I was great at. I also learned what it took to build a fund. And so I was very lucky that there was a senior partner there who had been in venture for 30 years. And I got the rare experience of getting to have an apprenticeship, really. And to learn under him the ins and outs of not only how do you source great deals, but how do you manage them? How do you become a great board member? How do you manage a portfolio? How do you exit stock? How do you do M&A transactions? The soup to nuts of the practice of venture capital, which I think has been sadly lost by a lot of kind of in many instances, solo GP funds. I got the best of the best when it came to that apprenticeship. And I also got to do the crazy, fun, interesting thing of building a venture brand all from scratch, right? So this was not a big fund with a lot of process and clear rules. This was really building the plane while you're flying it. And I absolutely loved it. So it scratched the entrepreneurial itch. And I learned so much, so much there. And I'm really grateful for that time.
So at what point does it become, you know, an opportunity? Right? Like an idea that comes knocking to you after almost 8 years, you know, of, hey, maybe I can build one of those on my own, you know, and create my own destiny. I mean, at what point does that become clear?
You know, it's interesting because I hearken back to what I was saying about kind of who I've always been since I was a kid. And I think that ultimately I knew that I wanted to own the thing that I was making. And while Bolt was an incredible platform and training ground for me, I was also really investing against someone else's thesis, right? Bolt was very focused on this intersection of hardware and software. I was developing my own areas of interest and thesis areas that were, you know, a little bit adjacent to that. And I was pushing at the edges of what Bolt was about. And I also knew that if I was going to build something and dedicate 10 more years of my life to it, I wanted to own it. And I really wanted the LPs to be betting on me, right? Believing in me. And so there were a lot of recruiters, you know, if you're someone who's especially a woman who's been in venture for almost a decade, I, you know, had some great deals under my belt. I got recruited to big funds all the time. And it was very easy for me to say no to those roles. But when the opportunity came to really start something new on my own, you know, with partners, but it was just, it took me about 30 seconds to think about it. Even though there was a ton of risk, it was just clear that this is what I had to do. If I was going to continue to be an investor, I wanted to make my mark, and that's how Balcoons was born.
So how was it, you know, that process too of meeting your partners and getting the band together for the fund?
Yeah. So, you know, we actually all met at Bolt, and a couple of us were, one of us was on the we had an engineering team. One of us was a principal. I had just been promoted, and then the original senior partner. And we had to decide if there was going to be another Bolt fund or not. And it was very clear to us that, and to me, I'll speak for myself, there was a bigger opportunity out there beyond hardware and software, right? That wasn't about, you know, just that staying in that vertical. We wanted to do more. I also know that the grass isn't greener on the other side. When you have a team of people who you trust and like who execute at the highest caliber, like that is something to hold on to. And so we really decided that a few of us wanted to spin out and go start this new thing. And we did. And actually, we were very lucky to have our one of our investors from Bolt anchored Baukunst and kind of stepped up and anchored our fund. And that really put us in business. And we were then able to raise the $100 million really on the Baukunst strategy, which is quite distinct from the Bolt strategy. But I think that one of the things that has guided me in my life and in my career is just work with the absolute best people that you can. Like, you are only as good as the team that you're playing on. And so you want to be with people who raise your game. And whether that person is your analyst, you know, or your admin or your you know, co-founder, like everyone has to be raising one another's game. And I know that I've got the best team in the world. So it's really an honor to play with them.
What was the journey like of raising? Because $100 million to invest in pre-seed is it's unbelievable, right? So that's a lot of checks that you can write. So how was that journey of really raising all that money, especially for a first-time fund?
It was incredibly hard. I mean, it's so interesting because we had this really big, successful fundraise. A lot of people think, oh, it must have been really easy. If you raised $100 million, it must have been really easy. And let me tell you, it wasn't. Not only did we need to raise the $100 million, but I was also a new mom. So I kind of became a mother, was coming out of the pandemic and raising this fund all at the same time. And I actually think that something that Phil Knight talks about, you know, in his book about Nike, is sort of you do it when you don't have any other choice, right? Failure was not an option for me. Where I was doing this with a baby on my knee, and failure was not an option. And I think that I look back on kind of the insane guts that we had to even target $100 million, you know, and I'm really proud of us for setting that goal. It was audacious, but we wouldn't have, you know, we wouldn't have reached it if we hadn't reached for it. So I think like one lesson that I had was go big, right? Go big, dream big. And then I think in terms of the fundraise, it was a terrible time to fundraise. It was a horrible market. There were wars starting. You know, it was just a very difficult time to raise. And any manager will tell you that. But there were a couple of things that worked. So I'll talk about what worked. So the number one thing that worked were personal relationships. And that sounds so obvious, right? But we spent a lot of time pitching the usual cast of characters that you would think should invest in an institutional pre-seed fund. And none of them converted, right? Like it was not the usual suspects, the people who you think are putting content out there about how great it is to be an LP and how they should back emerging managers, they were not the people that came through for our fund one. The people that came through were people that we had been on boards with, right? People that we had worked with. People we had built relationships with, and they had seen us in action, and they knew that there was work ethic and craft and thoughtfulness behind what we were pitching. So ultimately, it was personal relationships and folks that had really seen us and our track record as board members, as investors, that ended up creating the bulk of the fund. About two-thirds of the money came from that. So it was difficult. And really, I had to forget everything that I thought I knew about fundraising. And everything that people tell you about fundraising ended up being not true for our fundraise. And I think having the insights to stop going, you know, after everyone who people tell you to go after and to really double down on our personal relationships was definitely what made it work for us.
What kind of LPs did that end up looking like?
So we have three major buckets of LPs. The first major bucket is very large, multi-billion dollar family offices who all have entrepreneurial roots to the capital. So we found that like entrepreneurs got it, right? They really got it. And so we have a number of very large multi-billion dollar single family offices who have fairly sophisticated investing practices. And that's about a third of our LPs. The next third were corporate strategics who we really admired and had, you know, long-term relationships with the C-suite. And we focus on the frontiers of technology and design. And so we have a couple of corporates who represent, so it's a small number, who represent a third of the capital, who are really at the bleeding edge of, you know, leading $10 billion plus market cap public companies who are the leaders in, you know, software at the frontiers of technology and design. So there's a kindred spiritness to kind of what we were excited about, what they're doing. And those have been phenomenal relationships for us. So that was the second third. And then the last third was individuals. Many of those individuals were folks who we had invested in the past. So we had a lot of founders we had backed who had exited their companies, come and invest in us. We had folks from our former operating backgrounds. You know, one of my partners was on the core iPhone team at Apple. So a lot of Apple DNA in the individuals, designers, engineers, really people who are phenomenal builders in the categories where we are investing came and invested in the fund. And many of those have become a very powerful collective for sourcing investments and supporting them, et cetera. So a third, multi-billion dollar single family offices, a third corporate strategics, and then a third individuals.
Hey guys, so pardon the interruption here. So I got to tell you that, you know, for those of you that are either looking to raise money or you're looking to get your company acquired, you don't have to be alone. You know, there's a lot of psychology that needs to be blended with strategy, with methodology, with process. And it's very hard, and already doing your business alone is super, super difficult. So I remember, you know, back then when I was an entrepreneur, I kept really experiencing the challenge of either knowing or finding the right type of access to the right type of investors or really understanding what was the right type of guidance, you know, that would carry me through the process, whether it was with seeking money or with going through the acquisition. So that gap that I found being an entrepreneur is ultimately what pushed me later on when I met my co-founder at Pantera, Mike Severson, to really put together an advisory firm where we are guiding entrepreneurs and founding teams through the capital raising efforts, whether you are at a seed stage or at a Series A stage, or if you are going through the process of an acquisition and you are in small to mid-cap type of a cycle. So again, you know, we would help you from guiding you and supporting you from A to C, all the way to the end as an extension of your team. And there's no reason for you to do this alone. So with that being said, if you would like to find out more, feel free to send me an email at alejandro@panteraadvisors.com. And we would love to take a look at helping you out.
So it's interesting because it's a lot of money to invest in pre-seed, right? So out of the 100 million, how many pre-seed investments are you thinking about doing there? What's going to be the follow-on strategy? Give us kind of like the 30,000 foot view on the way that you guys are thinking about this 100 million.
So we modeled a very, I would say, concentrated strategy for pre-seed with this size of fund. So we are very ownership focused. We're big believers that if you get to conviction on an investment at pre-seed, go all in. So we'll do roughly 30 to 35 investments. The check size ranges from 500K to 1.5 million, But the majority of the investments we've made so far have been in the 1.2 range, so kind of on the larger side, size of that range. And then our average entry ownership is very high. So we're modeling 15% average entry ownership, and we're actually beating that in the fund. And the reason why I think that's really important is because right now the pre-seed market is very fragmented, right? There aren't a lot of angels out there. If you're getting money from angels, you know, the checks are relatively small. There are small pre-seed funds who are doing maybe 250K, maybe a little 500K. But if you're a founder, and we back a lot of folks who are kind of mid-career, you want to raise that money and you want to get to work, right? And you want a high-quality partner that is going to help you on that journey. You don't want to go raise from 30 people. And so we really solve the whole financing problem for the entrepreneur by having the guts to figure out how to diligence and how to underwrite founder market fit and the opportunity before there's traction. And so by doing that, we're writing a big check very, very early at pre-seed, and we're commanding the ownership that I think is super important if you want to have a valuable fund in the long run, given future dilution, et cetera. So we're big believers in investing off of high ownership and big believers that kind of really solving the financing problem for that high quality founder allows you to command that ownership. So that's kind of the basic fund model.
So what does the, when you find like, oh my God, you know, type of, founder or deal, mm-hmm. what does that typically look like when it comes to pattern recognition?
So I would say the core archetype in our, fund is really, an experienced professional who is in the top 1% of their field. And they are starting a company to revolutionize that field, right? So we have a company in the collaborative manufacturing space, let's say. The CEO of that company, he ran the Model X manufacturing at Tesla. He ran R1 launch at Rivian. Like, this is someone who was at the top of the manufacturing game, right? He was also called the Elon Whisperer, right? He's taking his experience as being the top 1% of that field, and he's building the software tool that he wished he had to kind of help the rest of the manufacturing world catch up to what he knows. Similarly, we're investors in an interesting company that's revolutionizing publishing, that's kind of taking influencers and turning them, or tastemakers, and turning them into publishers. And that company is started by the former head of product for Patreon, who also has been in the, you know, book startup world for a long time, and a book packaging executive of 20 years, right? So these are people who are in the top 1% of that field, and they're coming together to totally transform the field with technology. So that's the core archetype of what we're looking at. We have a couple of folks in the portfolio who are, you know, they've exited previous companies for $1 billion, or they were formerly the CEO of a publicly traded company. That's like a slimmer part of it. And we have a couple of kind of younger first-time founders, but the bulk of who we're looking at are seasoned professionals revolutionizing their professions through technology.
So let's say you have the opportunity of going to sleep tonight, Kate, and you wake up in a world where the vision, you know, of your guys' fund of Buckens is fully realized. What does that world look like?
Oh, that's a beautiful question. Well, Baukunst means the art of building. So Bau means building in German, something like Bauhaus. And then Kunst is art or craft. And so really the goal of our fund is to advance the art of building companies at the frontiers of technology and design. And I really believe that the core drivers of value, monetary value, and also cultural value come from that mix of technology and design. And I believe that the venture capital asset class has become a bit too obsessed with technology in isolation and has not been thinking enough about the ways that design and technology can transform things for the better. So I really believe that if we're successful, we will advance the art of how we build companies towards a more eco-centric instead of ego-centric model, and that we will also think critically about how design and technology come together to build products that really center a world that we want to live in, right? And doesn't just fetishize tech for tech's sake. It can feel dystopian sometimes to sort of see what's getting funded and ask yourself, are people really thinking about the world that this is going to create, right? So we're certainly not anti-technologists, but we do believe that that design piece is really critical to creating a more abundant version of capitalism.
So for the entrepreneurs listening now, when we're talking about building great companies, what would be the one piece of advice that you would give them before launching a business?
Pick the smartest person that you don't think you can get. The ungettable VP, the ungettable co-founder. Like, reach higher for your collaborators. The thing that I've seen with the companies that break out, right, versus the ones that they do okay and get acqui-hired, they kind of, you know, become good businesses, but not great businesses. The great businesses are all founded by CEOs and founders who go and find people who they perceive to be even better than themselves. And they are unintimidated by that greatness. They are called to that greatness and they go and make the impossible possible. There is just this boldness to believing that their mission is worthy of the absolute best and a totally brazen attitude about bringing people onto that mission. So I really do think that the first 10 people that you attract to that company will set the tone for how that company is built, the quality of that company, the creativity of that company. So really going and getting that ungettable talent is the number one thing that I would tell people to do.
I know that you also came out with a book that you wrote with your sister. Your sister is more in, you know, more of a brand strategy. So obviously you're more on the investment side. So tell us about what can people find in this book?
So we wrote this book, The Goddess Guide to Branding, together as a sister project, kind of bringing together our expertise. And in the book, we introduce founders and wannabe founders to 8 goddess archetypes. And we introduce you to Diana, the free, and Athena, the wise, and these deep feminine archetypes that blow past the paper-thin stereotypes that we have seen so many brands built on, you know, in decades previous. And then we show how these archetypes are alive in thriving, powerful, profitable, big businesses today. So in the book, you know, we speak to leaders like, you know, Sally Krawcheck from Elevest, you know, a fintech company, to Laura Modi from Bobby, which is an infant formula company that I backed at the pre-seed level, you know, way back in 2018. And we really show how these archetypes are alive in businesses today, thriving businesses today. And then we take the founder through the journey of finding an archetype for their brand. And whether you're starting, you know, a cybersecurity company or a preschool co-op, right, you need a brand, right? You need to be able to tell a story of who you are, you know, what you're offering, why people should care. And so this book is really an accessible, fun, powerful way to connect with, you know, female founders and builders and show folks how to do that. So it's a really fun book, and so excited for it to find its people.
So for the people that are listening, Kate, that would love to reach out and say hi, what is the best way for them to do so?
So I'm on TikTok and I'm also on LinkedIn, and those are great platforms to get to know me on. I'm super responsive to comments and love interacting with folks on this platform. So those are great ways to get to know me.
Amazing. Well, hey, well, Kate, thank you so much for being on the Dealmaker Show today. It has been an absolute honor to have you with us.
Super fun. Thanks for having me.
If you like the show, make sure that you hit that subscribe button. If you could leave a review as well, that would be fantastic. And if you got any value, either from this episode or from the show itself, share it with a friend. Perhaps they also appreciate it. So also remember that if you need any help, whether it is with your fundraising efforts or with selling your business, you can reach me at alejandro@pantheraadvisors.com.
You've reached the end of another episode of the Dealmakers Podcast. For free resources and materials, head over to alejandrocremades.com. Thank you for listening, and see you at the next episode.